Chapter 10. Is this a hockey arena? The purpose of this book is to tell you my journey, from beginning to current day, from childhood dreams to the current fruition. This is a journey full of accomplishments, failures, happiness, and heartbreak. We all, of course, live through this wide range of emotions and experiences, and hopefully for each of us, in the end, the positive has outweighed the negative. At the conclusion of the last chapter, in a few short paragraphs describing my personal life, I quickly took you through most of 2008, from my broken heart to moving out of my house and becoming a divorcing parent. It wasn't a quick 10 months, however. It was rather drawn out painfully, as if I were slowly pulling an arrow from my chest. My personal life was in ruins, and I hid it from my kids as best I could. But when children are part of the family, and thus in the middle, the process is more difficult and confusing, and you must weigh what is best for everyone in the long run. But this book is not about a broken heart. More than half of all marriages end in divorce these days, so I'm not relating anything that many of us haven't already been through. Also, I know that my marriage didn't end after 14 years because of one issue. I accept plenty of blame, knowing that my wife and I didn't address and repair problems and disagreements that existed almost from the very beginning. The problems near the end weren't the cause of the marriage falling apart. They were the symptoms of a marriage that was already in serious trouble. So while my personal life was taking a nosedive to depths I'd never imagined, my professional life was beginning an ascent on a trajectory that I'd never dreamed possible. It felt like the fabric of all I had become was being torn in two different directions, with threads and strips still connecting the two, but with a tear that was becoming more obviously defined as time progressed. After canceling 5 days of shows in late January, I forced myself back on the road to fulfill contracts and show up for performances that had been sold out for weeks. Deep down, I knew that everyone has problems and that mine were very small compared to people who were going through things that were much sadder and dealing with difficulties far more severe than anything that had been dished out to me. I knew that all of us have to push through obstacles in life the best way we know, learning and living and moving forward. Additionally, besides the people that had already paid for tickets, there were also a great number of folks who relied on me for their own income. Everyone from my agent to the guys who swept up after the shows. I kept reminding myself that I was living a dream and I had a great deal to be thankful for. At times, I was almost ashamed that I was allowing myself to wallow like this, so I forced myself on stage. In all honesty, my heart wasn't in it, but I was trying. Jeff Rothpan, my now good friend and opening act, was on the road with me for the first few weekends, and we simply worked. I never truly knew how much all this affected me until not long ago when Kenna and Ashlyn and I were at Caesar's Palace during one of my weekends there. Kenna picked up the What's Happening in Vegas magazine from our hotel room table, and she and Ashlyn looked at my photo on the cover. "Dad, this was taken when you and Mom were splitting up, huh?" Kenna said and asked this, both at the same time. I looked at the cover. It took me a second to examine what I was wearing in the picture and to remember the photo shoot when that particular shot was taken. Sure enough, it was a photo from a shoot right after I knew my marriage would end. "How did you know that?" I asked. Ashlyn replied with Kenna nodding, "You can see it in your face." The size of the theaters we were now playing in was growing. In February of 2008, we were playing 2,000 to 4,000 seat houses regularly. We usually planned the tours in a way that made sense for easy travel. But now the ticket sales were big enough that we could build in a few typical touring amenities, which would eventually become necessities. The first was a tour bus. I'd never seen inside a tour bus before. I really hadn't paid much attention or even cared because who would ever think that a ventriloquist would be on an actual tour? But now we needed reliable and flexible transportation, so we picked out a brand new one from a company in Nashville, where most U.S. tour buses call home, and had the interior completely customized. Of course, we had bunks for me, Robin Tate, Brian guitar guy Hayner, who was now my permanent opening act, and Jeff Rothpan. But I also needed some workspace, and I don't mean office, though the bus had one of those as well. What I'm talking about was a workshop. Every so often, the characters need maintenance, like a lever replaced or some paint touched up. Also, I wanted the freedom to be able to build anything new for the act that I might need, so I emailed the tour bus company a list of required hand tools, power tools, supplies, and even correct lighting for painting, and a few weeks later, voila! The bus company had removed 8 of the 12 bunks and built me an entire mobile workshop. Next, they added an elliptical machine, a lounge in back, a kitchen and dining area in front with microwave, refrigerator, and freezer, a pull-down TV in each of the 4 bunks, and 4 big flat-screen TVs, and even a couple of Xboxes and PlayStations. Cool! They also installed surround sound in both TV areas, plus another smaller flat screen and surround sound at my workbench. Good Lord, this was awesome. And yes, this was on-the-road opulence. This bus became my haven for more than half of every month.
I don't care if you make the bus look like a rolling palace. It's still a damn bus.
But it's a tour bus.
We're driving around the country in a bus. The only difference between us and the Beverly Hillbillies is that we forgot the chickens. Ooh, let's get chickens. I quit.
Travel was pretty simple now. We would jump on a commercial flight, land at the first city of that particular run, find the bus, and be taken to the theater. Then after the show, we'd pack up the dummies, jump on the bus, and head overnight to the next town. At first, I thought this was going to be easy, with luxury and plenty of time to kick back and enjoy. What I didn't consider was that this schedule made every day a travel day. We never slowed down. While we were setting up for the show and then performing, the bus driver was at the hotel sleeping those 6 or 7 hours. Then he'd wake up after we'd packed and take us to the next town. Honestly, I was working harder than I ever had, but no complaints. On the contrary, the work had never been this rewarding, and the fans were awesome. As many miles as we were putting on planes and on the bus, we were bound to have our share of unexpected moments and maybe some unwanted excitement. At the very opening of the book, I mentioned being rescued by a terrorist. Let me tell you exactly how that went. Every so often, our travel needs to get from gig to gig wouldn't match up with commercial flight schedules, so we'd have to rough it and get on a private jet. Not too shabby, but we were still subject to, well, fate. One evening after a show in New York, Brian and I had to fly all the way back across the country to Medford, Oregon, for a show the next afternoon at an Indian casino. Well, after the 6-hour flight, it was now about 1 a.m., and we were coming in for a landing at the Medford airport. In the last moments, our pilots decided to abort the landing due to heavy fog, and we had to divert. So we turned toward a place called Klamath Falls, Oregon. The pilots hadn't done much research on this particular destination, and upon landing at the not-so-large Klamath Falls Airport, we taxied to a halt on the tarmac, and the pilots informed us that since the tower was closed and no one was on the radio, they were going to pick a far corner of the airport next to the biggest hangar and just sit there until either the fog cleared in Medford or we got ground transportation. So after parking the plane and as they were shutting down the engines, suddenly 4 military Humvees came roaring up and surrounded our plane. Floodlights ablaze, we then heard a very commanding voice over an incredibly loud PA announce, "All occupants of the aircraft, you must exit the aircraft immediately with your hands in the air, 50 meters apart, one at a time." What the? Honestly, my first thought was that we were being punked. I thought any minute Ashton Kutcher was going to jump out of the bushes laughing. Wrong. This was legit, because as we looked down the aisle, our pilot was scrambling out of his seat, trying to get the door opened and the stairs down, all the while shaking like a leaf. He then went down the stairs and outside with his hands up. As he got there, I swear I could see him shaking more as he looked around. The co-pilot then made his way to the steps, and he too looked like he was about to cry. Side note, our captain, the first guy, he knew who I was, what I did for a living, and he knew the characters. The co-pilot, new guy. Didn't know anything about me. Keep that in mind. I then said goodbye to Brian and made my way down the steps, hands in the air. As I got outside, I then saw why there was even more panic on the pilots' faces. No joke. Surrounding us, about 25 U.S. Marines, all with M4 rifles pointed straight at us. I turned to look, and now Brian was gingerly making his way down the stairs. The difference was, while the pilots and I had our hands straight up in the air, Brian looked experienced at this because he had his hands on the back of his head. The pilots and I looked like we were in a Western. Brian was on COPS. Standing side by side, hands in the air, the guy got back on the horn and bellowed, "Who's in command here?" The captain of our plane went forward, and now it's just the three of us left standing there. And as we stood there, I thought, this is just a horrible misunderstanding. What can I do to get us out of this quickly? No joke. Without moving my lips, I whispered to Brian, "I'm going to try something." Then Brian started making unintelligible noises without moving his lips, but he wasn't very good at it. All I heard was, Then just to mock Brian, once again without moving my lips, I said, "Ha ha, you can't do it." Remember the co-pilot? He has no idea what's going on. So now I'm thinking, okay, this has to work. So I raised my voice pretty loudly and bellowed, "Excuse me, gentlemen." A few more rifles suddenly came around, right in my direction, pretty much pointed at my head. "Do you guys know Ahmed the terrorist?" This is about the time the co-pilot pissed in his pants and Brian about fell over. There were a few beats of silence, then one Marine yelled,
"Yeah, we watched him on TV last week. He's funnier than hell."
I said, "You guys, that's me." Another beat of silence, and then a second Marine, "Hey, we bagged Ahmed the dead terrorist." About then, the co-pilot fainted, we all shook hands and took pictures with each other, and we were off on our merry way.
"You're welcome, infidels."
"Thank you, Ahmed."
"I thought this was comedy. It would have been funnier if they'd shot your ass."
Thanks to the success of Jingle Bombs, we decided that a holiday special made a lot of sense. Again, the wheels of business started to turn. Comedy Central was on board, and I started working on Christmas material and a brand new show. The true genesis for the Jeff Dunham's Very Special Christmas Special came many years before when a parent at our daughter's school invited the Dunham family to her annual and fabulous Christmas party. Jackie Boggs had two sons, both near the ages of my kids, and with a few other school families, we became a pretty tight-knit group, taking trips and vacations together. But back in the very early years, when the girls were teeny tiny, Jackie asked my wife if I could pull out one of the characters during the party and do a little something for everyone.
Ugh.
I'd always dreaded performing for friends and family because they know you too well, and it usually felt more like work than fun. But I thought about it for a while, and on a long plane ride across the country, I recalled some discussions with my old friend David Erskine many years before regarding Bergen and Charlie reading a short piece of The Night Before Christmas together in one of their radio broadcasts. Erskine sent me an audio tape of the show, and I remembered Charlie messing up the story a bit to big laughs and how funny that seemed to me even 50 years later. So I thought, why not do the same thing with Peanut, but put a really twisted take on it with contemporary references and jokes? You hear of hit songs being written on cocktail napkins in a matter of minutes, and that's exactly what happened with my version of this Christmas classic. 20 minutes after I'd started, I was very proud of what was later to become a big part of my act. It certainly wasn't a unique idea, as every holiday season, multiple TV shows, musical artists, and comics come up with a satirical take on that old story. But I made my own version, and it was vintage Peanut.
Everything I do is vintage Peanut. Even the new stuff.
When I started performing it, I realized how much cooler it would be if Brian the guitar guy came out and played a Christmas song on electric guitar while Peanut and I read. And without any rehearsal, we did it on stage. Pretty soon, it was a great bit. We couldn't, of course, leave out Ahmed and Jingle Bombs, so that became a highlight in the show. Brian wrote Roadkill Christmas for Bubba J, and now the special was really coming together. Rothpan and I wrote Christmas and holiday jokes for all the characters, and every night during every show, we began to turn my regular stage show into the Christmas special. Granted, this was the spring of 2008, and we were doing almost 90% Christmas material. But God bless the fans, they loved it. I found over the years that audiences love being a part of the process, and if they know that they're getting a peek inside what few other people get to see, it makes the process almost a game. That's also one reason I don't mind screw-ups now and then. As a comic, if you can roll with a mistake or misspoken word, not let it throw you, and then acknowledge to the audience that you're okay playing the fool, the crowd loves it all the more. So every night, I would tell the audience that we were practicing for our upcoming Comedy Central Christmas special, and they would go nuts. It was now June of 2008. Yes, June. Granted, a strange time to be pretending it's Christmas, but that was the latest we could shoot to have the special ready to air by Thanksgiving and have the DVDs in the stores at the same time. We were in Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Pabst Theater, the beautiful Pabst Theater. We were set to tape two shows that night as usual, but unbeknownst to the audience and me, a couple of big disturbances were heading our way. Violent and threatening storms accompanied by tornadoes and green skies had put Milwaukee under a blanket of heavy rain and lightning, plus tornado warnings. 30 minutes before curtain, parts of the theater were flooding, and a critical electrical grid went out moments before cameras were to roll. I tried to push all those distractions and concerns out of my head and simply do my best to concentrate on doing the show that I'd done so many times the past few months. What was weighing on me much more heavily than weather and technical difficulties, however, was my precious family, which was in the midst of falling apart. And it wasn't as if that was a problem 2,000 miles away that I could just put out of my mind for a couple of hours. Quite the opposite. Ever since I performed The Night Before Christmas with Peanut at our friend Jackie's party, my wife had encouraged me to put the bit on tape somewhere and sell it. I had resisted for many years, wanting to wait until there was a true demand for it. I thought it was too good to waste on a cheap production, to then be used as a small moneymaker hawking the homemade DVDs at comedy clubs. I knew it could be big if I just waited for the right time and place, and now we were there. My family had meant everything to me. I married my wife when I was 32 years old, and along with her came 2-year-old Bree, her daughter from an earlier relationship. Bree became my daughter when I adopted her not long after the marriage, so my family started to grow very quickly. But as an adopted child myself, I had never known anyone who was related to me by blood, and the first time I held and looked into the eyes of Ashlyn and Kenna, I felt a lifelong isolation slip and melt away. The career was simply a dream and a driving force behind achievement. My 3 children and my wife were my world. In my first 3 DVDs, you can hear all 5 of us woven throughout the material, especially in my stand-up. For the Christmas special taping that weekend, my wife and my 2 youngest were there. It had been decided almost at the last minute for all of them to be there, and I agreed to it because Christmas had always been the biggest of all holidays for us as a family, and this taping was a significant part of our past because of the Peanut story. As a marriage comes to an end, I think most couples go through the last throes of existence trying to either sustain matrimonial life or rid themselves of unwanted encumbrances. I also think that many of these moments can't be defined as to which type they are. Is it a fight to push away or to pull together, or a confusion and a convolution of both? While in Milwaukee, though we tried to hide them from the kids, a couple of the arguments were huge and heated. One was even in front of crew and some of the public. I put my heart and soul both into my family and my professional life, and that night the two sides were pulling me apart again. But just like a sports team can win a game against an unpredictable opponent because of the relentless hours of practice they put in for so long before the game, it was having done the same show over and over throughout the preceding weeks that got me through that night. Whoever was there for the early show knows that I took a while to find my stride. I started into my stand-up and very uncharacteristically forgot my lines and my story a mere 2 minutes into the show. I had to start and stop a couple of times, but finally the adrenaline and the muscle memory of having done it so many times kicked in, and twisted Christmas magic began to happen. We slapped the PC thing in the face right off the bat when Walter came out and I wished him happy holidays. He snapped back with, "Screw you! It's Merry Christmas!" to a huge round of applause and even a hoot from the crowd. The funniest part to me about that joke was that many of the main players in my career at that time were Jewish, including Rick, my agent, Stu, our executive producer, Rothpan, my head writer, and a few other guys, and they all thought that joke was funny as hell. In fact, if I remember correctly, Rothpan wrote that joke. Ay vey. Ahmed altered his own greeting to, "Merry Christmas! I kill you!" And while I read the lovely and traditional Night Before Christmas, Peanut managed to demolish it with this kind of banter. And now I will read The Night Before Christmas.
"This would be a good time for the Muslims to go to the bathroom."
Peanut, enough. "'Twas the night before Christmas."
"And all the Jews were at the movies."
Peanut.
"Eating Chinese food." "Sorry, just trying to include everybody."
"'Twas..."
"Hold it!"
"What?"
"Who says 'twas'?"
"It's in the story."
"It's old and stupid."
"It's tradition."
"Tis it?"
Later we got to the part about hanging stockings.
"Seriously, how did that tradition start?"
"What?"
"Hanging up dirty laundry hoping Santa would fill it with goodies. I'd like to suck on this candy cane, but it smells like Dad's feet. Good thing the tradition wasn't a jock strap." "Sally, what's in yours? Nuts?"
"You are ruining the story."
"You're the one eating out of your underwear, pervert."
Along with all the Christmas and holiday jokes, Ahmed sang Jingle Bombs, and Bubba J sang Roadkill Christmas, and Brian, of course, came out to play along with Bubba J's crooning.
"I like to sing in the shower, too."
"How about washing? Have you thought of doing that while in the shower?"
"Huh?"
The results of our Christmas in June couldn't have been merrier. When the special finally aired in late November, it drew 6.6 million total viewers, making it Comedy Central's most-watched telecast ever. The special even surpassed the classic South Park episode, "Cartman's Mom is Still a Dirty Slut," which pulled in 6.2 million viewers in 1998. Proud company to keep, I must say.
"And I was worried about your mother hearing shit happens. Good Lord."
The summer and fall of 2008 included the second of those 3 surprises I referred to before. The first surprise had been the international acclaim. The second came when ticket sales in theaters in the United States began to exceed the saturation point and talk of arena shows started. I said, "Do what? What do you mean an arena?" I had no idea that we would even attempt anything larger than a big theater with 3,000 or so people. But now, Robin and Robert were talking about doing basketball and hockey arenas. Soon, we were filling arenas that sat between 5,000 and 16,000 people per show. We had huge video screens as tall as 30 and 50 feet that made it possible for everyone to see the action up close, with a view unrivaled even by the front few rows at a small comedy club. Backstage was no longer a green room with a couch. Now it was subterranean parking with two buses plus two semis filled with giant packing cases full of lights, sound equipment, and video components. We had our own 11-member crew with guys that had names like Psycho and Chovy. All hardworking and tireless, they would travel by bus at night, show up at a venue at 7 a.m., then spend the entire day rigging and setting up. That night, they'd run the two-hour show, then tear everything down, pack it into the big rigs, and be on the road again at 1 a.m. and on to the next arena to do it all again. So, without a doubt, we had taken that next crazy step. We'd gone from theaters to the big time. And trust me, I wasn't taking any of this for granted. Every time I'd walk into one of those arenas, I'd look around and just shake my head and think, how in the world did this happen? It was a rock tour, plain and simple. One of my favorite things to do when we showed up at an arena was to ask the venue's manager what act had been there the night or weekend before us. We'd get answers like Nine Inch Nails, Bon Jovi, George Strait, or the Monster Trucks. I'd usually get a laugh when I'd then say, and now, you have a puppet show. Sometimes I get the question of what my worst moment on stage was. Well, the scariest ever happened in November of 2008 at the Comedy Festival in Las Vegas. I was one of five headliners who would perform solo at the Coliseum at Caesars, each on a different night. The other comics were Cat Williams, Ellen DeGeneres, Chris Rock, and some guy named Jerry Seinfeld. To be in that venue on a list with those names was truly something I didn't take for granted. This was the theater that had been built for Celine Dion many years before. It seated 4,200 people, and I was booked for the Saturday night of the festival. Not only was this an important gig because it was in front of so many industry people, but it was a huge opportunity with Caesars, too. If I did well, there could be a future with them with more bookings, possibly multiple weekends a year. Even a show in an arena with 10,000 people didn't matter as much as this one gig. This could be one of the rare career makers. The Coliseum was packed, and the applause was thunderous when I walked on stage that night. This was one of those rare times when not only I was enjoying the moment, but so were all the folks around me who had worked long and hard to get me and my little guys on this stage and in this venue. But this night meant more to me than most people realized. My parents had brought me to Las Vegas when I was 12 years old. We drove around town looking through a few casinos and then saw the taping of a very early Siegfried and Roy television special. I remember walking through Caesars, even back then, thinking it had to be the greatest casino on the entire strip. And for 20 years since moving to Los Angeles, I had been visiting the city, playing smaller Vegas rooms that were makeshift comedy clubs, always walking or driving by Caesars and wondering what it would be like to be on a big stage there with my name up in lights. Then in September of 1978, Edgar Bergen announced his retirement and that he would be doing his final shows opening for Andy Williams in Las Vegas. After his performance with Charlie and Mortimer on that last night, his closing words were these. Every vaudeville act must have an opening and a closing, so I'll pack my jokes and my little friends and say goodbye. Edgar Bergen, the man who had inspired me in my life's work, died in his sleep that night, having done his final performance at Caesar's Palace. The irony and the poignancy of that first performance for me at Caesar's was almost too much to add to the evening. Those closest to me in the audience that night claimed they never knew anything was wrong. Maybe I had done it so many times that I pulled it off without any noticeable stress. But unlike the Christmas performance, there was no starting over after a screw-up. There was no kicking it into gear and shaking off cobwebs. It was do or die. I hadn't been on stage for a couple of weeks, and I hadn't really gone over my set before the curtain went up. I just figured it would all fall into place like usual. Good Lord, how many times had I done this show? After Brian did his set, then the video intro ran, I came out, did my stand-up, then got Walter out first as usual. But about 3 minutes into Walter's segment, my mind started to wander. There was nothing unusual about that. Sometimes I'll find myself in the middle of a performance thinking about where I wanted to have dinner, or if the Cowboys were doing well this season, or if I'd left the lights on in the kitchen. That night, however, my mind began to wander to a not-so-safe place. I started thinking about where I was and what I was doing and who was watching. Then suddenly, way out of left field, some kind of weird panic attack hit me, and both sides of my brain jumped the tracks and everything came to a grinding halt. I had absolutely no idea what came next. I didn't even know what joke Walter had just told, yet I was hearing the laughter die down in typical timing, but there was nothing next. Nothing. I didn't know what was supposed to be said and by whom, nor could I even remember any other joke or bit of Walter's that I could jump to while I figured out where I'd left off. And then, for the first time in my life on stage, I started getting lightheaded. The room started to swim, and I could just begin to hear that buzzing sound. I suddenly felt clammy. Sweat formed on my brow, and I felt my knees go weak. The laugh was now finished, and silence had enveloped the Colosseum. And just as I was about to falter and either faint or admit to the audience that I was lost, some instinct of fight or flight must have kicked in, because the next joke exploded in front of me and Walter was talking again. As he spoke, I had to consciously regain composure and force myself not to think about anything other than performing, plus not fall over or drop Walter. I just had to do my act. I have no idea how long that moment lasted. Everyone told me that there was never a single pause or hiccup in the show. I could have sworn it was obvious to everyone, and that I must have looked like a zombie for at least a few seconds. You'd think I'd look back at that story as a funny one, but I don't. It was just too dang scary. Kind of like almost being run over by a bus. I've never looked back at that tape, and I really don't want to. I don't remember where exactly in Walter's routine it happened, and I don't care. All that mattered was Caesars kept having us back, but I won't go on stage there ever again without cheat notes in my back pocket. Early 2009 was spent much like the previous year, doing arenas and traveling the country. But after the ratings from the Christmas special, Comedy Central was now willing to do a lot more with us. As the press called it, we made a full 360-degree deal with Comedy Central, which included promises of a fourth special and DVD, a television show, a touring sponsorship, and even extensive merchandise development and sales. Next on the agenda was my first European tour. When they brought the idea to me, I thought for certain we were talking about just England and Ireland, you know, where English is spoken most of the time. I was mistaken. The YouTube clips and Comedy Central specials had made Ahmed and company superstars in some incredibly unexpected parts of the globe. So on this first jaunt, we played sold-out arena gigs not only in London, England, but also in the Scandinavian cities of Stockholm, Copenhagen, Helsinki, and Oslo. You'd think that these would have been difficult gigs at the very least, and that the translation of language, not to mention the translation of the sense of humor, would have been tough as well. Honestly, exactly the opposite. The crowds of between 4,000 and 8,000 people each ate up almost every joke each night. Boy, did they know the characters. Spark of Insanity and the Christmas special DVDs had been released in Europe, but not my first one, Arguing. So since Bubba J was only in Arguing and hadn't yet been introduced into the marketplace, no way would any of the Europeans know who he was. I was in for a big surprise. The opening show of the tour was in London at the Apollo Hammersmith, a beautiful and historic venue where everyone from Mr. Bean to the Beatles had played. I brought Bubba J along, but had left him at the hotel that afternoon, simply because I knew I wouldn't need him since no one knew who he was. Well, the video opening that we'd brought with us to start the show included a quick appearance of Bubba J. As each character came on screen, the audience would hoot and holler for their favorites. As we got close to the Bubba J clip, Brian and I were standing backstage listening to the crowd, and I said, "Oops, forgot about Bubba J. These guys are going to be clueless. Should have cut him out of the video here." I was dumbfounded when little white trash Bubba came on screen talking about Budweiser and Walmart, and the crowd went nuts. What the hell? Needless to say, Bubba J made it into the shows on the rest of the tour and was somehow a highlight. Go figure. The audiences in Europe loved the show, and later in 2009 we made another international trek, heading down under to Australia, playing Melbourne and Sydney for two shows in each city. Equally enthusiastic as the Europeans, the Aussies made it obvious that we'd be returning for more shows there sometime soon. The Jeff Dunham Show was a television project that many great people put all their efforts into, although it wasn't exactly the concept I had envisioned and sought all those years. For almost two decades, I had imagined doing nothing but a sitcom. However, Comedy Central just didn't do traditional sitcoms, so we had to come up with something that made sense for the network, but also fit the characters in me. We decided to create a television show that showed the characters interacting with the real world. We would put them in real-life situations and with ordinary people. Sometimes I would be in the segments and sometimes I would not. It made perfect sense to all of us and the network. Writers wrote and the wheels turned. We taped and edited for many months and then shot the live studio pieces with studio audiences introducing the taped segments. It turned out to be an incredibly expensive production, almost double the typical Comedy Central budget. But the live audiences in studio loved it. Everyone backstage knew we had a hit on our hands. When the series finally premiered in late 2009, ratings were off the charts, but we knew not to get too excited because in television, rarely do ratings for subsequent airings stay as high as the premiere. We also didn't mind some of the show's critics because those people weren't our audience. There were plenty of other successful shows on the air that were far more offensive than what we were doing, so we let that stuff roll off our backs. If someone was screaming about what they didn't like on our show, that would make other people tune in because they thought that part was the funniest. After a few weeks, the ratings finally settled down to what normally would have been good numbers for Comedy Central. We were coming in just below their number one program, South Park. The problem was, because our show was so much more expensive than anything else they had on the air, it was beginning to look like it would be a non-profit venture. Comedy Central didn't cancel the series, as they kept airing it and repeating the episodes. They did, however, choose not to renew the series. In the end, it didn't surprise me, and I tried not to view it as a failure, but more as a learning experience. In Bergen's movies from the 1940s, there were scenes with Charlie by himself or interacting with other actors in the films without Bergen. We utilized the same formula in our television show, with my characters being independent of me now and then. We thought those pieces worked and were really funny, but what we found in research in the following months was that those were the segments that the audience really didn't like. In other words, people most wanted to see the guys and me together. What we didn't realize until too late was that for the viewing audience, this is when the magic truly happens. It isn't just the characters coming to life, it's the relationship between us that makes the best comedy. Also, when I was alongside the characters, it helped knock the wind out of some of the outlandish things the little guys would say. That's how it works on stage, too. If one of the characters tells a joke that's offensive, I'm always right there to counter it and argue with their sometimes callous sensibilities. It's a comedy team. I'm the Abbott to the Costello, the Penn to the Teller. Those individuals are funniest working together, and so it was with me and the guys.
We learned a valuable lesson. There is no I in team.
But there is in ice cream.
In the end, we could easily point to the segments that were audience favorites and to those that didn't work as well. The exception to this line of thinking was my favorite piece, Ahmed and the U.S. Marines. I say it was my favorite because I couldn't believe we were actually where we were, doing what we were doing. It was also, however, one of the most difficult segments to tape, mainly because I had to put myself and Ahmed in incredibly unnatural positions that kept me sore for days afterwards. But on shoot day, when we landed by helicopter at Camp Pendleton, the actual Marine training base just north of San Diego, I was stoked. Here we were, working with actual U.S. Marines who all said they loved Ahmed and who wanted their picture taken with him. I was like a proud dad, in a weirdly twisted kind of way. In addition to the real one, we also had a few stunt Ahmeds that we blew up and had run over by giant military vehicles. Plus, Ahmed got screamed at pretty brutally by a few of the training officers, and that made me laugh. To see Ahmed on screen trying to do push-ups with these guys in his face like he was a real recruit was just too darn funny. Another segment that involved Ahmed gave me the heebie-jeebies for a few weeks afterwards. The setup was that the little terrorist had never had a proper funeral, so now he wanted one. We went to an actual mortuary, and Ahmed took the tour. What made the episode not so fun for me was when he had to sit up from inside a coffin he was trying out to talk to the funeral director. There was only one way to be able to make this work. We had the top half of the coffin open so Ahmed could lay down, then sit up. But to operate him, I had to get inside the casket and then ball up into the fetal position in the lower portion of the casket with that half of the lid shut. I had a flashlight to see my notes and could hear the muffled sounds of everyone talking, but no actual contact with the living world. That was creepy. And by the way, I know what it feels like to lay in a real coffin now. Lots of springs and not much back support. Sheesh. Also scattered throughout 2009 were a good number of notable national television appearances, as well as some big-time articles on me and the guys. Bonnie Hunt and Carson Daly welcomed us, as did Leno and David Letterman again. Oh yeah, Letterman. Now that's a difficult one to even remember what happened. The next showbiz tale I'd like to relate is probably the absolute closest I've ever come to a crashing and burning on national television. It has a happy ending, but it was close. Oh, so very close. We had just flown back from our first European tour, and I took basically a nap at home in Los Angeles before then jumping on another plane and heading out for a full weekend of shows in Northern California. No rest for the weary. After the Sunday night show, I then hopped a red-eye across the country to New York City, where we landed at about 8 a.m. I backtracked 3 days in my head and realized that the miserable cold I now had, I must have picked up on that long, stuffy international flight from Europe. A guy in front of me was sneezing and sniffling and hacking the whole time, and I was run down as could be. I was now suffering the consequences of his cold.
There is nothing worse than you getting a cold.
Why do you say that?
I haven't exactly figured it out, but if you get a cold, the rest of us sound like crap.
I took a long and laborious cab ride to a hotel in Manhattan for a 3-hour nap because I then had to get over to the Ed Sullivan Theater to appear on Letterman again. Remember, they tape in the afternoon, not at night. I was constantly making sure I kept the post-nasal drip to a minimum because that's what would take my voice away. I had tea, honey, throat lozenges, plus day and nighttime cold medicine. As my alarm blared around noon, I went into the bathroom and downed what was to be a well-timed, daytime, very powerful and effective cold medicine. I'd planned for exactly when the best time to take it would be for the most relief at the most opportune time for performing, and that was right then. As I threw away the now empty cardboard box of Alka-Seltzer Plus daytime cold medicine, I turned to walk out of the bathroom. Then I stopped. Wait a minute, I thought. I don't have any more daytime cold medicine. I was going to buy some more. Oh, shit! I ran back to the trash can and yanked out the box. Oh, shit! I yelled it again. Then a few more colorful words came flying out of my mouth, too. I hadn't taken any daytime cold medicine because I didn't have any more. In my stupor, I had downed 2 Alka-Seltzer Plus nighttime tablets. Holy crap. I'm a lightweight when it comes to medicine. I rarely take any, so when I do ingest them, they work. Rehearsal was in an hour, and the actual show began taping in 3 hours. Holy crap, I thought again. Everything went through my mind in a second. I had never made myself throw up before. Plus, I figured the stuff was already in my system since it was in liquid form. Crap, crap, holy crap.
I couldn't stop laughing.
It wasn't funny.
That's why it was so funny.
Big shows and these national television spots are always performances I prepare and over-prepare for. I try to work like an athlete, eating and drinking just the right things, exercising and rehearsing just the right amount, in the right timing to make sure the body and mind are in the best shape to do the best performance possible. I had no idea what to do about this screw-up. It threw off everything. I got my clothes and peanut together and headed over to the set. Robin was there since he'd been with me for the weekend run, and I told him what happened. "Go get a carton of Red Bull," I pleaded. "That's the only thing I can think of." I always drink one small Red Bull before every show, but this time it was going to be a lot more. "Sugar-free!" I yelled after him as he ran down the steps. I was starting to feel heaviness behind my eyes. Good God, I thought. The memories of those moments are a little blurry now, but I know I made my way downstairs and to the stage. Waiting for me were a couple of producers, plus all the stage guys, Paul and the band, and everyone important. I figured I would be able to push through the rehearsal with just a little haziness from the meds. Almost every story and every moment in my life that I've written about in this book, I can recall in great detail no matter how long ago it was, except this one. It's all very fuzzy. I remember that I got a few lines into a very simple 4-minute routine and then stopped. I repeated a joke I'd just done, then hit a roadblock. The medicine was now hitting me full force and I was doing everything I could just to hold my eyes open and keep Peanut from falling over. Keep in mind that everyone was watching me, including possibly Letterman, who was probably at a monitor somewhere thinking he was being punked. I started and stopped a couple more times, then had to ask what the last joke I just told was. The guys back in the control room, as well as the director and producers, were probably looking at each other thinking, "Is he drunk? What's wrong with him? Can we even use him?" I remember that I stopped and asked for someone to print out the jokes that I had emailed to the show a few days before. I knew I could do it by looking at that sheet. I then explained very truthfully what had happened, apologized, and reassured them wholeheartedly that I would be fine for the actual show. Honestly, I don't remember much more than that, other than downing about 4 Red Bulls minutes before I hit the stage. Adrenaline, a little extra time, and energy drinks were my friends that day. The spot went great, and I was certainly happier with it than the time before when I was censored and edited. My team and I all laughed about it later and it became a great story, but I've also tried to learn something meaningful from the experience, and I think it's this. Don't forget the Red Bull.
You should have had beer.
Beer would have made it worse.
Well, yeah, but you wouldn't have cared.
I got my first big break with The Tonight Show, and since then, NBC has always been very good to me. I'm a big admirer of Jay Leno because for 30-something years now, he has been one of the hardest-working stand-ups in the business, constantly traveling coast to coast, performing in every venue imaginable. He is tireless and committed, and when it comes to hosting The Tonight Show, no one can argue with his numbers. After an almost 10-year hiatus from being on with Jay, however, I made up for lost time and appeared 3 times on The Tonight Show in 2009. The third appearance that year took me and my people, as well as Leno and the producers, by surprise. In December, I was booked on the show to promote my Comedy Central show. The plan was for me to have a brief chat with Jay by myself, telling a quick story, then pulling Peanut out for a few jokes. They asked me to have 2 or 3 stories ready for my solo part of the interview, with questions given to Jay in advance to lead me into the tales. Well, my first story, which was a true one about tricking Rothpan into going to a Miley Cyrus concert with me and my girls, went so well that Jay decided to forgo the dummy part of things and just let me tell another story without a dummy. My entire appearance on The Tonight Show that night, unlike any other time or any other show, was only me. Peanut never made it out of the suitcase. For the first time ever on television, I was just me.
Well, congratulations on that solo appearance.
Thanks, Peanut.
It only took 38 years for you to be funny without me.
After my segment, I walked back to my dressing room, and there waiting for me, all stone-faced, waiting for my reaction, was my little entourage of management, agents, and publicists. Since I never got to do my thing with Peanut, they didn't know if I was going to be happy or ticked off. I was doing everything short of a jig. This had been a big deal. As 2009 was coming to a close, there were articles on me and the guys in USA Today, Time Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, and the New York Times. It seemed like we were all over the place, and I was in the middle of a whirlwind career like I'd never known before. Now in this tale of my life comes the third of those big surprises that I've been talking about. This also happens to be the most important one, and that's why I've saved it for last. It's a dream come true and something that I never, ever thought could possibly happen. Ready? Here it is. I have actually become cool to my teenage daughters. I don't know exactly how it happened or exactly what I did. Is it all simply because of Comedy Central and YouTube? I will qualify it by saying that maybe it's just my imagination, but it seems that I have become one of those few very lucky parents who have the honor of seemingly not being an embarrassment to their children. Honestly, my daughters don't seem to mind when I hang around or take them and their friends to dinner. Also, I think they like hanging out with friends at my house, even though I'm pretty strict. No boys upstairs, that kind of thing. Granted, it could be that I just have incredibly kind and loving daughters who don't want to hurt my feelings, or, and I do mean or, I just might be funny even to them. But that seems like a long shot.
Long shot.
Long shot.
Long shot.
My tooth is loose.
Thank you, my loving and beautiful daughters. You don't ever need to buy me another present. Just keep letting me hang. Oh, and please keep downloading songs on my iPhone. Thanks to you, I seem hip to friends when they look at my playlist. The year of 2009 ended with me playing a part in the Steve Carell, Paul Rudd movie, Dinner for Schmucks. Though I had a small part, it was my first feature film, and I introduced a new character that I created just for the movie. Diane was the only dummy I've ever built that is, well, anatomically correct, at least from the waist up. Besides her head, I also sculpted her upper torso, and she has some darned impressive boobs. It was one of the few times that my daughters steered clear of my workshop at all cost, but I thought the body was very tastefully created art. Well, it was art up until the point that the movie's paint guys got a hold of her body. It quickly went from art to pornography. In full color, her breasts were even more impressive, I must say. One of the coolest parts about being in that movie was where we were on location to shoot the exterior scene of the mansion burning down. It was the original Wayne Manor, Bruce Wayne's mansion from the original 1960s Batman television series. But alas, no Batcave. I checked thoroughly. Besides the sound of laughter, one of my most rewarding parts of all that has happened in the past few years has been the ability and opportunity to give back to people in need. Beginning in 2009, I decided to take a dollar from every ticket sold in the arena and theater dates and put the money aside for charity. When a significant amount has amassed, my business manager and I decide where to distribute the funds. Most of the time, we've given to food banks in cities that have unemployment greater than 10%. It's been a truly great experience for everyone involved. I present the check on stage at the end of a show to a representative from the local food bank, and the audience is able to see what they helped to do. Of all the times and places we've been able to give, my hands-down favorite was at the American Airlines Center in Dallas, where I was performing for 13,000 people. It felt like a homecoming show of sorts. We gave $50,000 to the Dallas Food Bank and $50,000 to the Salvation Army, where my mother still volunteers. I had Mom walk out on stage and help give the check. Then all 13,000 people sang happy birthday to my 80-year-old sweet mom. Dad was having a little trouble with steps at the time, so he got to watch and listen just off stage on a monitor. It was a magical time for all three of us. Also that night, I gave $10,000 to a representative from the Dallas Public Library for an overdue fine. In 1972, I checked out the book Fun with Ventriloquism by Alexander Van Rensselaer and never returned it. I pulled out the exact book and showed it to her and the laughing crowd. I then handed her the check but wouldn't let her touch the book. I, of course, still have it.
$10,000? Holy crap!
Pretty cool, huh?
No! I still have a library book from 1966!
As is pretty obvious, I love this quirky little art of ventriloquism. I consider myself to be one of those lucky people who happen to have found something at a very early age that I had a passion for. I've worked very hard to achieve some lofty goals, but I've always been supported by family and friends, plus I've been blessed by my maker, and along the way I've had a lot of help by a handful of some very significant and great people. There's also the fact that my parents pray for me constantly, and I'm pretty sure that's a big part of why things have gone so well for so long. Until I decide to call it quits, I hope this all keeps going and growing, because right now I simply can't think of anything I'd rather be doing. As I wrote these final thoughts, I was sitting on a plane flying back to the United States from our second tour of Europe. This time we did shows all over England, Ireland, and Holland, repeating one city from our first tour, where I was delighted, amazed, and honored to have played a second time in London, but this time at the O2 Arena in front of 12,000 laughing Brits. In a few months, we're heading to South Africa for some shows, and there's even talk of China. How the heck?
China! Cool!
What do you want to see in China if we go?
USA town! Please, please, will someone just put a bag over his head? Oh, that was my Halloween costume last year!
The loves of my life, my daughters Bree, Ashlyn, and Kenna, are all doing great, and I couldn't be a more proud father. As for my time spent off stage, I continue to fly helicopters, and I'm just now beginning to build my fourth kit. It will probably take a couple of years to complete, but I'm pretty sure this one will have Ahmed painted on the side. I love American muscle cars, both old and new, and as I have since the first Macintosh was introduced in 1984, I love all things Apple. As for New Horizons, both Peanut and Walter have an old subject to kid me about because I'm dating again. When I first met Audrey, she had no idea who I was or what I did for a living. She'd never heard of me or Peanut or Ahmed, nor any kind of pepper on a stick. You might have think that would have tromped on my ego a bit. On the contrary, it was refreshing. There were no preconceived expectations or suppositions, and never once during any of our first dates did she ask me to make something talk.
I'm not sure she knows what you do for a living.
Audrey just knew me as the guy who asked her out for a cup of coffee one day after being attracted to her by nothing more than her smile. As sappy as it sounds, the very first time I saw her, she was a sunshine that warmed me from the inside out. Birds tweeted, butterflies flew around.
Please stop. I'm gonna puke.
As a certified nutritionist and personal trainer, Audrey continuously has a handful of clients, and she also competes in bodybuilding competitions herself. She comes out on the road with Robin and Brian and me and the rest of the crew, encouraging all of us to eat more healthfully and exercise regularly.
She tells me to limit my kegs.
Most importantly, however, Audrey brought a peace and happiness into my life that I hadn't known for a very long time. John, Robert, Robin, Brian, and Judy had helped me through my darkest days as the best of friends do. And now after so long, I feel and share unconditional love with someone very special. The biggest vote of acceptance of Audrey into my life came from the people whose perspective I cared about the most, my parents. The first time they met her, we all had lunch at the cafe in Nordstrom in University Park, which is a few miles north of downtown Dallas. It had been a long time since I'd watched anyone meet my parents for the first time. Through Audrey's eyes, I got to see two of the most wonderful people I've ever known. I'd forgotten how charming and engaging and funny both my parents actually are. I think that sometimes we forget about the best traits of those we love the most because we start to take who they are for granted. We grow to overlook the best parts of people we're closest to. I saw my mother and father through fresh, genuine, kind, and loving eyes. And just as important, my parents adored Audrey from their very first meeting. Understandably, the acceptance of someone new in my life has taken more time for my daughters. Even now, a day doesn't go by that I'm not saddened at what happened to my marriage and our family. So much happened in the subsequent days after January of 2008 that even the family therapist has said many times that there is no going back. So, we move on. Life is short and precious, and I learned from my parents, and then later on my own, that laughter is not only an elixir, but a sustenance to life. And as Audrey has taught me, happiness is a choice. Onward and upward.
Good book.
Sweet ending.
Don't tell anyone I had a tear.
I love endings.
Too bad it's over, senor.
Well, thanks, guys. Actually, there's still an afterword.
Ah, hell.
It's endless.
My ears hurt.
Is this more romantic crap?